I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Hey up, you pop crazy youngsters, and welcome to the final part of Chart Music number 49. I'm your host, Al Needham, under heavy manners in Nottingham, and I'm linking up with Sarah B in London.
Yo!
And Neil Kulkarni in Coventry.
Hello, Chucky Bab.
How are we, duckies?
Apparently going the slightly mental, judging by my my hysterical introduction there. Hello. Hi, Al. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine, Duck. Absolutely fine. Are we exercising? Have we had our have we had our one exercise bit yet?
I can't, mate. I can't go out. It's so tense out there. Or it's tense in some places, not nearly tense enough in others. That's at the time of recording. People are mostly oblivious. And honestly, I'm like crisscrossing the road to try to keep my distance from people. And they're just strolling along. So I'm getting loads of exercise. When I have been out, I've taken so many more steps than I would do normally because of like just... scooting out of the way of people, you know. It's very weird. Just suddenly behaving completely differently in a space and looking at people, like, you know, because I was out with my bloke and he was sort of slightly ahead of me, and there was a bloke with a tiny toddler that suddenly swerved and started making a beeline for Matt. I'm like, ah!
You're basically playing Frogger, aren't you, Sarah?
Basically, yeah. And we should point out that the weather. I've always thought that the British weather had its own evil sentience, and I feel like that's being proved now, because, you know, this happens and it's like everyone stay in your homes and the sun comes right the way out and goes, tempty, come on out,
making wanker signs at us.
Now's when we need all that fucking rain. But I've had in as much as I've had a good gossip with my elderly neighbour over the back fence about new neighbours, about everything. It was a nice little 10-minute chat. But that doesn't really count as exercise. But it's fresh air. What the hell? And I didn't have a fag in my hand when I was doing it. So it counts, yeah. Absolutely.
Good lad.
Wow. Yeah, it does, yeah.
You're on lockdown with the youth dem, aren't you, Neil?
Oh, God, man. Yeah, and look, if I was a kid, right, and I'd been sent home from school and I knew that we wouldn't be attending for several months, I would not be fucking emailing my teacher looking for things to do. For fuck's sake, for all intents and purposes, we're on a massive snow day for a long, long time. Exploit that opportunity.
Yeah.
People want to do Skype meetings, Zoom meetings. I get that they want routines going on, but I'm very much of the, all of this could be sorted out with an email. Absolutely fine with just being left the fuck alone, thanks.
Yeah. We are discovering at this point, aren't we? Like, all of these things that could actually have been done online anyway, and all these things, all these meetings that were so important, and now it's like, oh no, we'll just do an email. It's like, it's taken a global pandemic for work to be, you know, to have its bullshit sorted out in that way, you know.
To leap into this century, really. It's been forced along. It's odd.
Yeah.
I should point out, though, that like there was a huge kind of slew of, you know, understandably, people going, use this time to make a thing, write the novel, do the thing. Yeah, and yes, however, it's also okay if you do fuck all, because, you know, this is a really intense time. People are, you know, a lot of creative people are also very anxious people. And it's like, give yourself a break. Anyone who's listening to this who's feeling a bit like, yes, I can write the novel now. I literally started on a novel. And am I going to finish it this time? Fuck no. No, because I actually, my head is so full of other stuff. I mean, I'll get some of it done, but I'm not going to, you know, it's not going to be, and here you go, thump, you know, a massive doorstop of a thing. It's like, behold my meisterwork that I wrote during this extremely anxious time. You know, it's like, give it, it's all right. If you don't create a damn thing except an amazing sandwich out of all the crap in your cupboards, like, that's fine. I am telling you.
Yeah, and kids can do that. They don't have to do meetings.
Well, I mean, as far as exercise goes, the other night, I found myself on, like, the busiest main road in Nottingham, and it was empty. I got my iPod on, and, you know, I just started doing the running pal right down the middle of the road all the way to the off licence. So liberating. And also, if there was anyone about, I didn't notice, but if there was anyone coming towards me, they'd be getting the fuck away pretty sharpish. So we're into the final stretch of this episode of Top of the Pops. Come on, let's not fuck about. Yeah, we can do this.
Yeah.
George!
Lots of movement. Shack Attack, a track called Easier Said Than Done. Okay, Top of the Pops about the best-selling singles. Here's number 20. At 20, Diana Ross, Why Do Fools Fall in Love. At 19, Cambodia from Kim Wilde. At 18, Flashback, Imagination. At 17, Still There, The Tweets and The Birdie Song. At 16, My Own Way from Duran Duran. At 15, Spirits in the Material World, The Police. At 14, Young Turks, Rod Stewart. At 13, It's Rock and Roll from Status Quo. At 12, Waiting for a Girl Like You, Foreigner. At 11, Wedding Bells, Gottlieb and Cream. And at 10, I Could Be Happy, Altered Images. And at 9 this week, we welcome to Top Pop Studio, John Anderson and Vangelis. Number 9, superb single, I'll Find My Way Home.
You ask me where to begin. Am I so lost in my sin?
Pow, who we saw dancing on his own at the end of Easier Said Than Done, is suddenly surrounded by zoo wankers who appear to have teleported right across the studio, including a new zoo wanker in a green jumpsuit who looks like the world's most effeminate Ghostbuster. Oh, man. Every time you look around, there's always one more zoo wanker who hasn't caught your attention. Then you can't stop looking at them.
Desperate for those future appearances.
Yeah.
Show-off bastards.
Woo! Lots of movement, he declares, and he's not lying. He then piles into the chart from number 20 to number 10 before introducing us to a superb single, I'll Find My Way Home by John and Vangelis. Formed in 1979, John and Vangelis were John Anderson, who had just left Yes after 11 years, and Evangelos Papathanasou, formerly of the Greek psychedelic band Aphrodite's Child with Demis Roussos, who was currently best known for the soundtrack of Chariots of Fire and had just finished the original soundtrack for Blade Runner. They had known each other since 1974, when Vangelis was mooted as a replacement for Rick Wakeman in Yes, and although that never came off, Anderson made guest appearances on 3 Vangelis LPs in the 1970s. They immediately hit pay dirt when their debut single, I Hear You Now, got to number 8 in February of 1980, but the follow-up, The Friends of Mr. Cairo, failed to chart. This is the follow-up, which entered the charts in mid-December. It bided its time during the Christmas break at number 10, and this week it slipped up one place to number 9, and here they are in the studio.
The audience are kind of really not doing themselves any favours here.
Yeah.
Because we do finally get to see them, but unfortunately this isn't really a danceable song. It's a pranceable song. In this weird kind of waltz-like time signature that really precludes any proper dancing. And also it's so fucking weedy that even the audience's somewhat dismal swaying doesn't really look right. This is actually one of those rare numbers where it would have actually benefited from forcing Zoo to come up with some kind of routine for this.
Yes.
Rather sort of mimsy, folky, proggy, synthy song.
Yes. Yeah, let's see ya. See you now.
And it's astonishing, really. I mean, this is the same year he's working on the Blade Runner soundtrack, Vangelis. You know, kind of, it shows what synths can do, that soundtrack. And yet this song is really just an old sounding Cat Stevens type number, a folky number, given a few proggy lyrics and played with synths. And it's, yes, I've been singing it all week. I will admit that. It's a catchy number. I've been whistling it. But it's not exactly suitable for Top of the Pops. To Anderson's credit, he looks like he's ridden the kind of Aventis crossover pretty well. Despite, this is a recurrent figure in this episode, clearly, despite looking like Bob from Rita Sue and Bob 2.
Yes, it does.
I thought I were great.
And I also really do quite like the strange cutaway in the instrumental section, where it cuts away to sort of various stills of John and Vangelis in the studio, crafting the magic.
Having fun in the studio.
It's a slideshow. It's a middle-aged slideshow. It's fucking, it's an innovation that I like, what I have never seen before. With the keyboards like forming a sort of a paddock around them.
Barrier.
In which to frolic.
I counted 9 keyboards there.
With this kind of thick, heavy blue overloid border. It's like the intro to Bagpuss, but for kind of...
Yes! Yes!
But, you know, this is what happens. I know it's a catchy number, but this is what happens when proggers write pop music. Mm. They kind of come down to it from their promontory of musical smugness to kind of deign to give us a simple tune that hasn't got 54 different chords in it.
Yeah.
And you invariably get this kind of nursery rhyme type shit because they slightly look down on pop. And really, when we think about sort of where the 80s are going to go pretty soon, that mindset of kind of simplifying what they want to do in a sense, and making these nursery rhyme type shit pop songs.
Yes.
We'd see that reach full fruition soon with the likes of Howard Jones and Nick Kershaw. At the moment, we haven't got new farts pointing the way. We've got these old farts pointing the way. Mm. But this song, catchy though it is, does kind of point towards an aspect of the 80s which is going to get increasingly vexing and annoying in coming years. That use of synths to craft these kind of sappy nursery rhyme type pop songs, often written by those with a prog mindset like Howard Jones.
I mean, Vangelis, he is a Radio 2 Giorgio Moroder, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he's the anti-Giorgio, if you will. All that talent, all that technology, but no flash or excitement. And, you know, the fact that he's pretending to do all the synthy stuff on a white piano, that, no, mate.
And he's wearing not only a sweater, but I had to peer at this because I was like, okay, so that's a sweater. And is that a scarf that matches the sweater in a sort of sweater set? Or is it like a scarf printed onto the sweater? And it's an actual scarf. It's a scarf. It's an extra garment.
It looks like he got it for Christmas off his auntie.
Yes, it's red.
And his mum's gone, you make sure you wear this, Vangelis. Spent all autumn knitting that.
But yeah, it's the never starting story, is this. And I think the Moroder comparison is quite apposite, if I may say so. But yeah, I mean, the Blade Runner soundtrack is just a magnificent work. It's fucking incredible. I mean, I love the movie, but I mean the soundtrack is almost better than the film that it soundtracks is. But I mean, this is a sort of malfunctioning water feature of a song. It's a kind of, there's a sort of dribbliness to it, and kind of vocals about everything's dribbling sort of as if over a suburban rockery. And I don't like John Anderson's voice. He's enunciating too much. It's very Eurovision. I mean, obviously Eurovision is an extremely broad church. But this is a bit sort of 5 points.
Yeah.
How many points is it in Eurovision? I can't remember. Is it deux that is the deux that is the big one? Yeah. And so it is a solid deux, 5 points for me.
Well, I hated this song because it was on radio all the fucking time. Mm. And as soon as it started, you knew you were in for a long haul.
Yeah.
You know, it was like being on a train journey and knowing there's a big tunnel coming up.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to sit there for the next 5 minutes, not being able to read your comic.
And a reminder as well that technology isn't necessarily salvation. I mean, this is essentially, like, synths are exciting, right? In the early '80s, synths are kind of exciting because of the noises that they make. But if they're welded to just kind of a weedy folk song, which is essentially what this is, you know, this is no different than a kind of, I don't know, a Cat Stevens cast-off, if you like. It's a negligible song.
Cat Shit Stevens, if you will.
Cat Shit Stevens, quite. You know, you can't polish a turd, can you? You can cover it with loads of glittery synthy stuff, but it's still basically a rather ploddy, dull folk song that would be best in the hands of an early 70s balladeer that I could safely ignore rather than, you know, being at the heart of Top of the Pops like this.
Yes.
Yeah.
But at least Vangelis is sitting down. We don't have to look at his arse.
True. Well, he has, you know, for all his faults, the man has dignity.
Yes.
Dignity always.
Yes. Yeah. And of course, no zoo wankers for this, as mentioned. We do see the back of the crab, but we do see that copper again. And he's got his arms up in the air in a reverie.
In a what, Al? In a what?
Reverie.
So I just wanted to hear you say it again. Thank you.
Reverie.
Mm. What? Carry on.
But what can you do to this record?
No.
I mean, I said you could prance to it, but you can't really even do that, to be fair.
Can you do the hobby horse to it?
You should have got Romo Ralph Wiggum back and just give him a stick. Give him one of them sticks with a handkerchief tied on the end and make him do some interpretive dance to it.
Absolutely.
Kind of like looking round for a road sign.
Yeah. He could have done a heartbreakingly poignant tableau to this.
He really could. Aww. So the following week, I'll Find My Way Home inched up one place to number 8. And the week after that, we'll get to number 6, its highest position. The follow-up, And When the Night Comes, only got to number 87 in May of 1983. And they never bothered the top 40 again. Although one track on the Friends of Mr. Cairo, State of Independence, was picked up by Donna Summer, who took it to number 14 in November of this year.
Yes.
The duo were put on hold in 1983 when Anderson joined the reformed Yes, and Vangelis concentrated on theatre and ballet work and the occasional solo LP, but they reunited in 1991 for the LP Page of Life.
Why?
Page of Life, fucking hell.
State of Independence, though, I have to represent for that. It is a
it's corker.
Yes.
It is a stately thing.
Oh, can you imagine if Vangelis had done I Feel Love?
Wow.
It'd be such a different world, wouldn't it?
Imagine what's happening in the timeline where that happened.
That's a different history, and it'll probably be a fucking horror history as well.
Yeah, but I bet things would be better now, but they would have been, you know. I don't know. It's a stupid thing to think about, but, you know.
No, if I Feel Love doesn't happen with Giorgio Moroder, then the 80s don't happen.
Really. Not our 80s.
Yeah.
Quite a big chunk of the 90s don't as well, so, yeah.
No.
Anyone who listens to my radio show will know I played it every single day for about 5 weeks. John and Vangelis, and I'll Find My Way Home. That's the number 9. What's the number 8? At number 8, it's Dollar and Mirror Mirror. At 7, Get Down on It from Kool and the Gang. At 6, Daddy's Home, Cliff Richard. At 5, One of Us on ABBA. At 4, It Must Be Love from Madness. At 3, Ant Rap from Adam and the Ants. At 2, The Land of Make-Believe from Bucks Fizz. And this week at number 1, in Top of the Pops studio, on Top of the Pops, The Human League and Don't You Want Me.
Pow! Surrounded by the Kids breaks down the rest of the charts from number 8, finishing off with this week's number 1 single, Don't You Want Me, by The Human League. We've covered The League in Chart Music's 11 and 39, and this, their 9th single, is the follow-up to Open Your Heart, which got to number 6 for 2 weeks in October of 1981. It's also the fourth single from the LP Dare, which kicked off a row between the band, who thought it was the weakest track on the album and felt another LP track as a single would be a rip-off, and Virgin Records, who were convinced it would be a nailed-on hit. After the label agreed to issue the single with a band poster and fork out for a decent video, the league relented and it was put out at the end of November. It immediately crashed into the charts at number 9 at the beginning of December, then soared to number 1 the week after, keeping Daddy's Home by Cliff Richard off the Christmas number 1 slot. And here it is, in its fifth week atop the summit of Mount Pop.
Oh.
And here's a clip of one of their previous appearances. This really is the swan song of the Avantis, isn't it? Both
is.
The song and the performance.
This appearance is just imperious. And it almost makes the entire episode worthwhile. You know, just like a great pop single can make the whole chart rundown worthwhile. You know, I've said sort of previously how in 81, you know, Non-Stop Erotic Cabaret just came into my world and shattered my world. But close behind it in late 81 and early 82 was Dare. And it's a completely different thing in a sense. Where Non-Stop Erotic Cabaret suggested all kinds of dark alleys and other lives, Dare sort of only suggested itself, if you like. It was really holistic and sort of self-contained. And although I preferred Love Action, Sound of the Crowd, kind of end of Human League, this was music that was clearly, it was too good to be played by traditional musicians. There was always this sense with the Human League that they both used their equipment amazingly, but they were also used by the equipment as well. So it's all about the little tiny details in this music, the drums and the little synth details. Martin Rushent recalls working with Johnny Harris, the band arranger, and learning arrangement, the ability to leave space. So in any Human League song in the Dare era, it's not just one kind of earworm. There's like a dozen little different hooks that you can sing to per song, sort of often happening at the same time. And getting Dare home and putting it on, because it was definitely an at-home listening experience.
Or if you were lucky, walk around with your Walkman. Or your Iowa copper.
It was like a test disc for your music centre, you know, for your stereo, because your ears just felt lavished, and it had this sort of simultaneous, gorgeous clockwork feel, thanks to the programming. But it also felt propulsive and like it was being played by humans. And crucial to that was the mix of voices. Phil just always sounded mardy. You know, he always sounded mardy ass, but just so much better than nearly everyone else who was singing to synth music at the time. He just had this control better than anyone else. I mean, think about it. Better than Simon Le Bon, better than Dave Gahan, and way better than Tony Hadley. There's sort of no cheese or weediness to Phil's voice, just power and what sounds like proper anguish. I would argue that vocally, Phil Oakey has much less in common with his contemporaries than he does to 60s singers, even if the bulk of the lyrics on Dare are kind of positive and pop-orientated. And, you know, in interviews at the time, Phil Oakey was kind of rejecting bohemianism, was all about professionalism and kind of entertainment. You can tell that by this period, in contrast to early Human League, that ABBA have become, you know, just as important to Human League as Eno and Bowie and everyone else. And this performance is just imperious. And it's also the kind of performance and the period, really, where in which Joanne and Suzanne become just so, so important to what Human League are doing. And you know, the video and the song rely on a certain ambiguity. Are these characters, or is that the Human League is singing about, or is this a projection into the future, in a sense of Phil the Svengali kind of hiring the girls for the band? And that the video was similarly meta, had really high production values, just like the record. So, you know, it's just the perfect, irresistible package, a whole record in which the story is contained and it's satisfying for exactly that reason. And as full a portrayal of that kind of abandoned, wretched Svengali figure as A Star Is Born, Judy Garland version, naturally. Like I say, in terms of Human League singles, I'd rather hear Mirror Man, I'd rather hear Love Action, I'd rather hear Sound of the Crowd, but this is just mammoth. And for anyone who's ever DJed will know that this, like Come On Eileen or Tainted Love, it just still wallops any UK dance floor, definitely. And it's just one of the greatest UK number one singles ever. I don't think anyone other than Phil Oakey has got that look that I love so much, that look of fantastic eyeliner, fantastic lippy, but being utterly fucking hench as well. I don't think anyone got it as right as Phil Oakey.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I can add to that. That's frame that, cut, print that. I mean, yeah, they are totally in control of their vehicle here, aren't they? I mean, it's just, it is a joy to see. It's always a joy to see someone who is in command of themselves and their persona and their whole deal, and the machinery just turning perfectly before your eyes and ears. It's just, it's fucking great. And it's one of those songs that is just, you know, that everybody knows and has almost been worn down a bit by time and familiarity, but will never be truly sullied, you know. It matters not, you know, how many kind of drunken hen night caterwauls it's put through, you know, nothing can diminish it. In fact, it's probably only enhanced by that, because that is, like you say, it's a dance floor filler. That's part of the collective experience that now, as I'm saying this, you know, fucking hell, everything just has this weight about it right now, doesn't it? It's like, oh, imagine a filled dance floor. When are we going to, you know, I look to the day when we're going to get on one of those again.
Looking through the top 10, Cliff Richard's got his hand on his face. I'm like, oh, mate.
We get different opinions about this record in a sense, because when those, we all know how this record.
Some people don't appreciate it.
Who?
Some people think it's cheesy, you know. I mean, well, dickheads.
Where are they? Let's get them.
Dickheads who can fuck off.
If you hear the opening portion of this record, if you hear that drum pattern and that sort of jittering synth pattern as well, you're there. You're on that dance floor no matter who you are.
Yeah.
I think Sarah's absolutely right that nobody here is not being themselves. That's the weird thing. It's such a glistening, perfect record. And yet nobody's not being themselves. Phil is completely being himself.
Yes.
And the girls as well. Susan actually sings, in a sense, not off-key, but it's not some sort of falsely strident thing that matches the peerlessness of the music in a way. It fits because everyone's being themselves, both the musicians, but the singers themselves, Susan and Joanne as well, are all just part of this thing, whilst not sort of inflating themselves in a sense. It's a really realistic yet majestic record.
Well, if you put aside Kraftwerk, you know, as we've already discussed, all the absolute greatest synth records are the ones that bring out the humanity of the people performing it.
Yeah, the women here are you know, obviously they are pushing against a degree of disdain, which would have applied anyway, but especially did because this was like the second, or was it the third, incarnation of the Human League. And it's like, oh, you got some girls, you got some dolly birds in, have you? And it is quite a bit of crumpet, a bit of skirt. But yeah, the way that she sings that verse, Suzanne, is it's very sort of northern and shouty and birdy. Yeah. I was working as a waitress in... It's like, it's loud, and it comes right from, you know... And then she sort of does it, you know, and then she sort of sweetens it up a bit. Says, I still love you. She softens it a bit. But yeah, and then in the chorus, I mean, so even though familiar as this is, you know, when you sit down to analyse it for such a thing as a podcast, you notice some things like just the kind of edge of malevolence, and that. But it's quite a pathetic sort of whinge, really. It's a pathetic male whinge, but delivered in this very powerful way by a handsome man in a full face of beautiful makeup and lippy, which is just kind of such a delicious combination, you know. And it's kind of a guy just, you know, just like, you'll be, you know, you will regret this because I'm entitled to that. You know, it's, oh, I don't know. You look back at it from somewhere like here, and you just, the stench of kind of entitlement is real, you know. And Joanne is doing the chorus and sort of just sort of cleaves very sort of closely to Phil's vocal line. And like now, just thinking of it in that way, it just sounds like she's sort of mocking him and just saying back to him what he, you know. Which is also great. Just everything about this is great and so clever, so right, isn't it?
One of the startling things, as Al's already mentioned, is that this, you know, the band didn't even think this was going to be a single.
Yeah,
you know, mental, the full single, and only the single on the suggestion of the record company. And I think what that reflects really is just how much hostility the girls faced in their initial entrance into Human League. Not just from sort of your spotty male fans of early Human League, but also, you know, female fans of Human League as well really resented the kind of introduction of the girls. And I'm wondering if the band, sort of knowing that this song could be interpreted as being about the hiring of the girls into the band, whether they just wanted to kind of head off that inevitable hostility that this record was faced, but it's staggering to think that this could have just been an album track, and that we would have never got to see the video and never got to see the Rover, the brilliant car that's in that video as well. And these things that are, you know, just such a big part of our memories of pop, might have just never happened. It's staggering to think that, but it's also just amazing that they didn't consider this a single, but as a track, it just makes the weediness of the rest of synth pop so apparent at the time, much like Soft Cell had done the year before, because this is just a great walloping song. And Phil invariably is key to the, putting a song across with that crucial mix of lippy eyeliner and just fucking henchness that he always got so absolutely dead on. Staggering to think it could have been an album track. Thank God it wasn't.
Yeah, I know. And if this isn't the swan song of the Avantis, then it's definitely the last in the line of massive number ones from synthy weirdos, for want of a better word.
Yeah, for me, there's a big drop-off after this. And I don't mean in terms of Human League singles. I just mean in terms of 80s number ones. This is the last kind of really, truly great 80s number one that we're going to have for a while. I mean, already in the 80s we've had Ghost Town, we've had Tainted Love. But after this, I mean, genuinely, as a pop listener myself, the next number one to really, truly, tremendously excite me would probably have been There's Nothing Now Until Frankie. I mean, I know we've got Adamant, we've got ABC and other things coming up this year, but this to me is a real, real high point. And sort of, it's one of the greatest number ones of all time. Better than Come On Eileen. Come On Eileen is not a great song and not the best of Two Rye. This is just one of the greats, one of the great number ones ever.
Yeah. Bit harsh on René and Renato, but I'll let it pass.
All of television history is contained in the Box of Delights.
I've climbed up Nelson's Column once before. These are small.
And put it down in front of Bagpuss.
I'm Julia Rayside. Join me and my guests as we dip into our favourite TV memories.
Suppose Mother Thursday bashing her head like this.
You can't tell me what to do. You ain't my mother.
I love when a plan comes together.
Come and tell us what yours are too.
We've all been told we can't discuss nominations.
It's a bit of car air.
Shut up with a novel on the top.
I think I'm like you, Lovejoy.
Find us on Twitter at Box Delights Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
As already mentioned, this is, looking back at this, this is obviously a repeat performance. And it's a chance to have a look to, at the Top of the Pops that I would already be missing this far into this episode. Is that band, is those people who have changed your life this week?
Yeah, yeah.
And here they are. And you can get to see, you can see all of them doing their thing. And you can obviously see the crowd are into it. It's like being at a gig, but a really good gig where there's no leads going everywhere and... you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a Top of the Pops I grew up with, and I'm already sad to see it disappearing.
You could just imagine what Zoo would do with
this. Oh, Jesus Christ, Neil!
I mean, they wouldn't pay it any respect whatsoever because they hate pop music, and they'd just do their usual jolly, brassy, happy steps. Because I'd never recall Zoo in any way emotionally reflecting a song in their dancing.
No.
Or paying attention or caring about what the lyrics to a song are. So you can imagine they would have just stomped all over this with their big idiot boots.
With wild faces.
So this appearance, like you say, it's a beautiful reminder of what Top of the Pops used to do so well and aren't really going to do much anymore. Let singers sing. You know, let bands band. They would have been there cutting it all up, without a doubt. So it's a heartbreakingly poignant reminder of what Top of the Pops was best at, this performance.
This is an oral 80s night poster, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But, you know, sometimes when you want to encapsulate an era, it is usually the best stuff that gets put up there. So, yeah, fuck it.
Definitely a high point of the 80s. And like most high points, it's dazzle kind of obliterates the shade, if you like. So you kind of forget how crap a lot of the 80s were because of records like this. This is a high point from one of those two or three years in which the 80s were just astonishing. You know, pop being made by real people, in a sense, that you could walk past in the street, you could imagine doing that. Walking past Phil Oakey, you might be a bit scared, but you would. and he'd be still part of this astonishing record. Yeah. This is definitely a high point record of the 80s.
So the following week, Don't You Want Me was finally relieved of its duties at number one, dropping one place to make way for Land of Make-Believe by Bucks Fizz. But they still pitched up on that week's Top of the Pops when the pop-crazed youngsters were traumatised by the sight of Being Boiled, a re-release by EMI which had entered the top 40 at number 19, Being Danced To by Dave Lee Travis. The official follow-up, Mirror Man, got to number 2 for 3 weeks in November and December of 1982, held off number 1 by I Don't Wanna Dance by Eddie Grant and Beat Surrender by The Jam. And in the summer of 1982, Don't You Want Me spent 3 weeks at number 1 in America and is considered the flagship record of the second British invasion.
Single gone Human League, Don't You Want Me, number one for 2 years now, and their album Dare is the number one as well, so a great time for them and a great time for us, and I hope for you too. We'll do it all again next week for another edition of Top of the Pops. Till then, here's Madness, It Must Be Love. Good night now, bye bye.
Even more kids are allowed to stand next to Powell, making him look like someone trapped in a bus shelter when Grange Hill has kicked out, as he points out that the Human League have been number one for 2 years and Dare is the UK's number one LP. He then invites us back next week and introduces It Must Be Love by Madness. We've covered Madness many a time and off, and this, their 10th single, is the follow-up to Shut Up, which got to number 7 in October of 1981. It's a cover of the Labby Siffre single, which got to number 14 in January of 1972 and became part of the band's live repertoire when keyboard player Mike Barson would play it at sound checks and eventually became part of their encores at gigs. When it was heard by Dave Robinson, the owner of Stiff Records, he insisted that the band put it out as a single, but they were dead against putting out cover versions only relenting when he told them he would give them the label if it didn't make the top five. When it entered the chart at the beginning of December at number 24, the video, which featured a cameo of Siffrey on violin and the band dressing up as Undertakers and putting the fun in Funeral, was played in full on Top of the Pops, causing Jimmy Savile to tell the pop craze youngsters afterwards not to play electric guitars in swimming pools, which set off a bit of tabloid nonsense. This time, the BBC have opted not to play an edited video, and as Suggs is currently out of the country on his honeymoon, they've elected to have the single, which has nipped up two places this week from number 6 to number 4, to the relief of Stiff Records, danced to by the Kids and the Zoo Wankers. Wow, fucking hell, this fucking song. And the minute you hear the opening, your heart just lifts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does, but my heart sinks as well because they're not there.
Yes.
Without an appearance and without a video, which was what Madness were all about for me as a kid. I loved the videos. Yes. I would have been heartbroken.
It doesn't feel right, does it?
I mean, truth be told, It Must Be Love, perhaps at that age, I didn't realise just what a beautiful, amazing song that is. Mm. I thought I would have been disappointed with its lack of nuttiness, if you like. And, you know, also there was this thing in Coventry, definitely, that Madness were kind of, you know, down to civic pride to a certain extent. An awful lot of older two-tone fans in Coventry were determined to stay loyal to the Cov stuff. And Madness were kind of looked down a bit on a bit as interlopers
Outsiders.
And a bit too pop. But any kid is just going to love Madness, especially on the run of singles that they're on. You know, we've got Driving in My Car, we've got House of Fun coming up, haven't we? We've just had Cardiac Arrest, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to, like I say, at that age, It Must Be Love wouldn't have been one of my faves, but what an astonishing run of singles this band was on. And gutted that it's Zoo dancing to them.
Well, yeah, because we start with the Kids, some of whom have been given flags to wave. And, you know, we're getting that school disco vibe that's beloved of chart music. But then, sadly, it gives way to Attack of the Zoo Wankers.
I've got in my notes here, good Lord, what are they all doing?
Mm.
Because it's the return of the strong men flexing.
Yes, they're back.
It's like he's.
This is not a song that you do a pose down to. It really isn't.
It doesn't make any sense at all. He's got on. It's like I'm looking at a man with. I'm trying to enjoy this song that I love very, very much, and I have to look at a man in a white leather studded collar with big fucking like studded the kind of like slightly health and safety wrongness. Studded collar and matching cuffs, and he's undulating his shoulders in other parts of himself. Yeah. And I don't want to see it.
Well, Zoo's performance would be understandable, you know, if they were Czechoslovakian and didn't speak English and didn't know what any of the lyrics were and just decided to throw a load of crazy crap at this thing. As it is, they have no excuse. Why is this going on to this record? And you know, this is the predominant question whenever we're confronted with Zoo performances. Why? Why are you doing this? Why must you enrage me so?
Yes.
With your idiot joy.
And that there is a way to dance to Madness that everyone knows. Everyone knows how to do it, you know. But nutty dancing. This is fucking knobhead dancing.
This is proper hands on the shoulders, hands on the hips. Disco shuffling about.
It's basically the sign language of woo, isn't it?
There is this kind of odd memory in my head, but I definitely recall dancing to Madness with Pricey and Taylor.
I'd love to see Taylor doing that.
It was one of the first times I'd ever met those guys. Mm. We were asked to do Bristol Sound City, which was kind of like a week-long music festival in Bristol.
Right.
And I'd never really met music journalists before. I'd kind of like been in the office like really, really infrequently, and I just found them, other writers, like hugely intimidating, basically because I was a fanboy and I was kind of, you know, I still had that sort of layer of fear, if you like, of these people I've been reading for so long. I mean, I've been reading Pricey and Taylor for so long by the time that I joined the Melody Maker. And, you know, but meeting them in Bristol that week, I rapidly realised that, not all music journalists are massively intimidating. And not all of them. I mean, it was like meeting old mates. Because the way that we could talk with each other and the way that we could talk about music. But more importantly, I remember that moment when we were in a nightclub and, a Madness tune came on and it wasn't all Shrinking Wall Violets just kind of talking about what we were hearing, we were immediately like, come on, we've got to fucking dance to this.
Yay.
And we naughty boy stepped onto the dance floor, as it were.
The bummer's conga, as David calls it.
But yeah, I mean, look, if me, Pricey and Taylor, drunk, could manage to get the dancing right to Madness back in 1995, surely Zoo, you know, professional bloody dancers could get it right, but as this footage shows, no, they couldn't.
Well, here we go. In the actual thing, you see Romo Ralph Wiggum.
Yeah.
He's doing the fucking nutty dance. Not very well, but he knows. And the Zoo wankers, you just see them. They are absolutely clueless.
Yeah, they don't know pop.
Yeah.
They don't listen to it. They don't care about it. They presumably have a bar across the middle of their sort of wall in their living room, and they just practice pliés and fucking moves and you know, pirouettes. They're completely detached from pop. I never got that feel from Legs and Co and Pans people. You got the feeling,
yeah.
Especially because they used to actually sing along to some of the songs that they used to be dancing to. That was a really telling moment in old episodes. You're not going to get any of that with Zoo. They ultimately might as well not have the music playing and just have a metronome ticking the time.
Yeah.
For them to do their nonsense.
Or Flick Colby banging a stick on the floor.
Well, quite, yeah.
And of course, you know, we get to see Powell chatting up a Zoo wanker in a Doric chiton. Yes, got to say Doric chiton again. Yes. And then they end up doing a bit of proper knees up Mother Browning. So he, you know, he's in the right postcode.
Mm.
But when Peter Powell's a better interpretive dancer than you, then you've got no right to be a professional dancer. Shame he's not doing the running man again, though. That was good.
True.
The horsing man.
Yes.
Neil, important question. Were you in the middle of the Nutty Boys when you Nutty Boyed? That's what I was trying to think of earlier. So when you did the Nutty...
I certainly wasn't in
the middle. I'm just thinking in order of height.
I may well have dreamt it, but why the fuck am I dreaming about that?
I may well dream it tonight.
Me, Taylor and Simon, that week, we really fostered... Oh, that fostered a bond. We weren't beating drums out in the forest. But no, it was the first time I'd met other journalists and they weren't scary, in a sense. They weren't intimidating. Do you know what I mean? They were just, we could chat shit. And we did chat a lot of shit that week. It was a lovely, lovely week. But I do remember, Nutty Boy dancing to Madness. Because I rapidly knew that these people would be my friends because they were the kind of people who, if a tune came on, they were like, fucking hell, we've got a dance, you know.
Mm.
Shrinking wall violets or anything like that. We were dancing.
Yeah.
It was good.
I do love this song very much. It makes me... There's an innocence about it that is so disarming. And it makes me messed up every time.
Yeah.
Every time.
Madness have that. Madness have that ability to... I mean, not... they were never a funny band, per se, if you like. The videos were funny, but they have this ability to cheer you along, joy you along, but also break your heart.
Mm.
They can put things in the middle of an ostensibly simple song like Our House or something that really gets to your heart. Yeah. And this one is a really good song about relationships. Unfortunately, we've got to watch fucking Zoo.
So the following week, It Must Be Love dropped 5 places to number 9. There's the Zoo effect for you. And the follow-up, Cardiac Arrest, only got to number 14 for 2 weeks in March of 1982, snapping their streak of 9 top 10 hits on the bounce. But they roared back in May when House of Funk got to number 1 for 2 weeks. When the Complete Madness video came out later this year, the band tacked on a warning by Lee Thompson at the beginning of the video, filmed at Camden Lock. In early 1992, nearly 6 years after the original band split up, It Must Be Love was re-released in advance of the greatest hits compilation Divine Madness and amazingly got to number 6 in February of that year, leading to more re-releases and the Madstock Reformation. And 20 years later, Madness's performance in an episode of Later with Jules Holland was held up when Suggs was ordered to change out of the Jimmy Savile costume he was wearing. So as the show plays out, we're reminded that the BBC has just released Top of the Pops Volume 9, featuring Rock This Town, Reward, Swords of 1,000 Men, It's a Mystery, Intuition and 10 more tracks on Super Beeb Records, with Legs and Co. slinking about on the cover. Oh, we miss you. They also shill their video cassettes Deep Purple, California Jam 1974, and Toya at the Rainbow for a mere £34.95 each. And that, me dears, closes the book on this episode of Top of the Pops. What's on telly afterwards? Well, BBC One immediately pitches into the new series of Wildlife on One with the episode Ambush at Masai Mara, where David Attenborough follows a herd of wildebeests on their annual migration and uncharitably refuses to shout a warning at them when the lions pitch up. The bastard. Then it's the penultimate episode of Seconds Out, the boxing sitcom starring Robert Lindsay, the 9 o'clock news, and a repeat of the first episode of the second series of Shoestring. Then there's highlights from the tennis, the news headlines, and they round off the night with Now Get Out of That, Takeshi's Castle for Oxbridge Types, hosted by Bernard Falk. Or is it Bernard Falk? I don't fucking know. I'm 13. BBC Two pitches into 100 great paintings, and tonight it's Goya's The Burial of the Sardine,
Corker,
followed by part three of the sports documentary series Maestro, which features Tony Jacklin. Then it's Russell Harte, who gives a free advert to a Scottish fabric company who has put on a big do in Munich, followed by the final part of the documentary series Dancing Girls, where two English dancers take a job in Las Vegas. After news night, they finish the night with an old grey whistle test special on the Doors. ITV hangs out Ryan's daughter all the way through the night, breaking off at 9 for the news, and they finally get stuck into the Monte Carlo show, starring David Essex, and sign off with What the Papers Say. So, me dears, what are we talking about in the playground tomorrow?
I think I would have been talking about the Meatloaf video mainly.
Yes.
That would have totally detonated my young mind. And I'd mainly be talking about Cher, to be honest. In fact, maybe I wouldn't be talking about Cher. I'd just be thinking about Cher in the playground the following morning with quite sort of confused and addled thoughts, to be honest with you, in my prepubescent mind. But I would have been massively thinking about that. I possibly also would have talked about Human League, because even though they'd been at number one for a while, it was always a joy just to see that. So I'd have been talking about how good that was.
Yeah, the Meatloaf video and, like, the possibility of one day that being my adult life, that I could, you know, dance on a bar in a tiny skirt and look amazing and be a massive badass.
And perhaps also, because, I mean, my sister seems to recall me basically moaning more than I praised, if you like, even from a young age. So I possibly would have also been starting to talk about how much I hate Zoo, although it wasn't a fully developed hatred yet, because I'd only just started, of course. I think I would have been talking about, yeah, my burgeoning dislike of this new dance troupe and how they were wrecking the programme.
You definitely have now. Yeah. You've made up for it. If you didn't, if you didn't have it then, you definitely do now. Yeah. That is a fact.
What are we buying on Saturday?
I would say, obviously I was too little, but I would say the Human League, except that I probably wouldn't be cool enough, so Meatloaf. And I'm okay with that as an adult.
I'd be buying Madness League Meat Pearl, I think, in that order. 4 corkers on this episode.
And what does this episode tell us about January 1982?
For me, it tells me that it reminds me that I was born a bit too late. I would have been, if 1982 was my year zero, I'd probably be my life would probably be better than if 1984 was my, pity me for 1984 was my year zero.
In terms of what this episode means about the early 80s and about 1982, look, 1982 is a good year, don't get me wrong. There's still lots of people who are going to bring out fantastic records this year. The Associates in Japan and ABC are just the ones that spring to mind. But there is already the sense for me that I detect in this episode of a couple of things. One, the kind of the way that synths had previously been so looked down upon, in a sense, by proper musicians. And had kind of been in the hands, if you like, of those non-musicians who were making amazing pop music, and in the hands of the freaks and the dissidents and those people. There is a sense in this episode that that technology is now finding itself increasingly in the hands of your proggers and your bland popsters, in a way, and not your freaks. Foreshadowing really what's going to happen in 83 and 84 when that stuff, synth music, really does pass almost entirely into those people's hands. So there's that on the musical front, already foreshadowings of perhaps how bad 83 and 84 are going to get. But yeah, I don't want to overstress that because 82 is still a great year.
I mean, for me, it's just like, oh my God, I really miss Legs & Co. I really do. The thing about Legs & Co and Pan's People was you knew who they were.
That's it, yeah.
And they had some sort of a personality to them. And you could pick out a favourite for whatever reason. And they knew their fucking place. It was just like, we're going to see them on one song.
For Top of the Pops itself, we're in this kind of... It's kind of, this episode is very, very definitive of 82, but also definitive of how... certain elements of Top of the Pops still needed changing. I think by 82, we have MTV kind of on its way in America. We have music videos really seen now as a promotional device by bands that all bands have to do, in a sense. So the argument for having a dance troupe at all, I would say, has vanished now. In 77, 78, you know, with Legs & Co, in those 70s episodes, there's a reason. If the band can't appear and there's no video, there's a reason for having a dance troupe. By 82, I can't quite see or establish a reason for there being a dance troupe in this show anymore. And it just looks horrifically dated.
Yes, it does.
It's not so much what Zoo are wearing that looks dated. You know, Zoo could not be more 1982. But even in 1982, I would have thought, what is the point of this? Why are we still having these dance troupes when they could just go to a video?
Exactly.
So this kind of halfway house makes Top of the Pops really not look like it's confident in what it is or knows what it is anymore. Yeah. So it's sort of in between pop and a light entertainment show in a way. It's indistinguishable from other stuff on telly, like the Hot Shoe Show or something that has dance troupes in. Get rid of that and just make it a proper pop music show. With performances and bands banding and singers singing and maybe videos videoing, you know. That was where pop was at that time. It wasn't really in this kind of netherworld of dance troupes. I think what could have successfully killed off the dance troupe idea would have been perhaps the hiring of Hot Gossip.
Yes.
As the dance troupe. And just a few nights of utterly inappropriate undulation and groin smelling would have been enough to get the dance troupe completely banished from Top of the Pops. But unfortunately, we linger on for a few more sad years with Zoo wankers overpopulating the stage, shouldering out the kids, misunderstanding pop music, looking down on it, and basically sustaining themselves but not really caring about the show. So, you know, we're at a kind of peak musically, in a sense, in 82, early 82, because pop is still vibrant, exciting and thrilling. But already there are signs of how the 80s might go. And there are already signs that Top of the Pops is going to have to adapt and change and move on and stop holding on to its 70s ideas, if you like, into the 80s, into the video age. It's going to have to compete with things. At a much tougher level than it ever has before. It's still our half hour of pop every week, but it's got to change. And unfortunately, Zoo is just a sort of changing of the guard, if you like. The essential idea of a dance troupe is what needs to change.
Well, you say there's no room for dance troupes anymore, Neil, in the early 80s, but I've got to beg to differ there because, you know, the great tragedy of the era is that this is the time that Les Dawson has got the roly-polies on. For fuck's sake, get them on Top of the Pops and call them Chip Pan's People. That's what you need to do. Imagine elderly people dancing to the hits of now. You'd watch that shit every fucking Thursday night until the end of time. Yeah, little Mo with a fright mask on dancing to Love Missile F-111. Who's not going to want to watch that? And that, Pop Craze Youngsters, brings this episode of Chart Music to a close. All that remains now is to do the usual promotional flange, which is www.chart-music.co.uk. Come and connect with us on Facebook, baby. Facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast. Reach out to us on Twitter at chartmusictotp and shove that money right down the G-string. Patreon.com/chartmusic. And seriously, we are even more grateful to the Podcraze patrons than ever before. I just want to give two special thanks to two special people. Doug Grant, you went over and above the call of duty just the other day for chart music. Thank you very much, sir. But also, I really need to thank Chris Oakley over in New Zealand, who out of the blue dropped a chart music wiki on us.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
So amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it? Bit of work, Mr. Oakley. Well,
if you're new to the world of chart music and you need to need to know what, I don't know, white pajama music is or something like that, or any one of the million things we just come out with, like the old sailor, you have to go to this and look at it and learn it and teach your children as well. Fuck what the schools are teaching them now. Get them to find out about Bummer Dog, I say. If you want to have a look at it, it's bit.ly. bit.ly/chartmusicwiki, one word. Oh, it's amazing. Chris, thank you, sir.
Thanks, mate.
So anyway, let's fuck off back to our shelters, I think.
Yeah.
So we'll see you soon. And yeah, we are going to have a think about bunging out bonus content. We are in talks. We're conferencing and all that shit, aren't we, at the minute. We're going to try and do something with you because, I mean, fucking hell, you know, there's not much else we can do at the minute but talk shit about old Top of the Pops. So until then, I just want to say take care, Neil Kulkarni.
Ta-ra.
Stay safe, Sarah B.
I will. And you?
My name's Al Needham, and I got the kind of arse that does more than shit.
Chart music.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Chart Music Theatre presents Ned's Atomic Dustbin's Brain Blood Volume, reviewed by Neil Kulkarni, read by Ace Batte.
Cherry red, dock wearing, stupid Bronx hat and shorts combo, sidewinding Carter shirt over PWEI long sleeve stripy tights. Pony owning, horse race, drippy please hit me. Mazzola haired, spotty sack of subservience girlfriend, having invade your local and share your shallowest thoughts. Play the Duke for 2 hours worth of shit. Sit there, mouthing the lyrics, looking at the door, trying to blend. Call brown ale, Nuki Brown. Drink it out of plastic glasses, pissed on too. Put glory box on to show how hip you are. Sit near to me and with every word of your cretinous jabber, make me want to rip your face off. Vegetarians apart from fish. Keep the spliff for too long. Hold it in too short. Bloat straight out and dribble a duck's arse all over the roach. Then giggle for half an hour and fall asleep as it burns off in your hand watching Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Blues Brothers, Angel Heart, Lost Boys, With Nail and Fucking Eye, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Betty Blue, whatever fucking stewed movie that irritates the fuck out of all the decent sane people. Skipping onto the dance floor for the poppies. Lean over into their mates' faces and shout the words so everybody knows you know them. Hug everybody you meet like you haven't seen them for 5 years, even when they've just come back from a piss. NME reading MM when you like the cover. Do the sailor's hornpipe to the levelers. Have a zany quotes board in your communal kitchen. Sneer at townies. Ruin every pub you set foot in. For 9 months a year, phone daddy for an extra grand and fax through your skid-marked shreddies. Red witch drinking. Talk in cinemas as loud as possible. Laugh at all the most annoying moments. Think the people in Dogs in Space are cool and not the wretched sticks of shit they are. Dennis Leary, Fantasy Football, Red Dwarf, Newman Badil laughing. Secret Jasper Carrot admiring. Clog up the aisles in supermarkets, individually levelling coffee granules. Daddy's working class. He owns British Steel. Louise Wenner wank over Blockbuster's theme tune. Dancing Lamarck Wiley, listening tie checkered shirt round your waist, goatee beard. Attempting waiting for your balls to drop. Say pants when annoyed. Terry Pratchett reading. Vic and Bob quoting. Stupid, dense, thick, crass. Scottish, daltish, dumb. Imbecile, dim, idiotic, asinine. Fatuous, inane, gormless. Snide, mindless, brainless. Daft, backsliding, pig cunt. Bastard scab, insect bitch, shite-eating, monkey spunk, gorging face, ass-headed, sweaty, ring-pierced, fucking scum. Yeah, I'm talking to you, motherfucker.
Oh, you'll love it.